or he would stop drinking.
If you answered yes to any of these questions, you are not alone.
Not everyone trapped by alcohol is an alcoholic.
Families and friends are suffering too.
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Call 1-866-200-0223 or visit alanon.org/help.
To me. Oh, I can't see why. Oh, my baby won't ride to me. Well, you know she got me all worried. What I told her, Bob. I said, tell her for me, baby. Well, I want you to tell her for me every day. Well, I want you to tell her for me, little girl. I want you to tell her for me every day. Well, you know I'm out here working for you, baby. Whoa, and you know I'm sending you all my pay. Well, I got the blues, people. What you gonna say? You know my telephone won't ring. Oh, you know the mailman won't leave no mail. Telephone on a strike. Woo! And they put the mailman in jail. I was getting to think something was wrong, baby, but I was really find out.
Listening to the Deep Blues Hour here on WRCT Pittsburgh. My name is Steve. Thanks for tuning in. We just heard from Sonny Terry. That was Cut Off From My Baby from a disc called Going It Alone, plus Mississippi Fred McDowell with Mama Says I'm Crazy. All right. We're listening right now to Earl Hooker and Blue Guitar to wrap up this hour. Be sure to stay tuned to WRCT for more great music here each and every day. But for now, I'll leave you with this blues on WRCT.
Michael Norm with your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. While coronavirus infections could go down over the next few months, we're still headed into flu season. Millions of Americans will be affected by the flu. But the good news is that we do have a safe and effective vaccine. But sadly, too many people go unvaccinated, especially African Americans. For more about flu vaccine, talk to your doctor or visit aawellnessproject.org.
I want to start today with a story that several of you sent me about a black Democratic leader who threatened, who was threatened with lynching for criticizing the former president, Donald Trump. Let's go right to the New York Times article. Iowa Democratic chair says he received lynching threat after criticizing Trump. Ross Wilburn, the first black person to lead Iowa's Democratic Party, said he received several racist messages after writing a column in the Des Moines Register. Iowa's Democratic Party chair said on Tuesday he received a lynching threat and several other racist phone and email messages after he wrote a column in the state's largest newspaper denouncing former President Donald Trump and Republicans. The party chairman, Ross Wilburn, the first black person to lead the Democratic Party in Iowa, the presidential proving ground, said that he turned the messages over to the police in Ames, Iowa, and planned to press charges if the people who sent the messages were identified. Speaking to reporters over Zoom, Mr. Wilburn, a state representative from Ames, said that the threatening messages were in response to an October 8th opinion article that he wrote in the Des Moines Register titled "Iowa Republicans Put Loyalty to Trump Over Helping Iowans." The column's publication preceded Trump's rally in Iowa, his first visit since losing in 2020 and since the January 6th insurrection. Wilburn said Tuesday, "At some point, we have to say enough is enough. We can't control thoughts that people filled with hate have. But when you speak out, when you choose to act in certain ways, that's when it's not OK." On October 8th, Wilburn said he received a voicemail from a restricted number ending with a threat that included a reference to lynching. Over the next 2 days, he said racial slurs were repeatedly directed at him in another voicemail and an email sent to his legislative account. Commander Jason Tuttle of Ames Police Department said in an email that Wilburn filed a police report and police were investigating. You know, one of the things here, there's so many layers to the speech rights that the right likes to claim. It's not shocking that the pro-Trump people, when they got angry with a black guy for criticizing Trump, they said racist things to him. That's not a shock. That's kind of like blasé in a sense, sadly, but it is at this point. We've become very, very used to it. You know, they really have this confounding, convoluted understanding of speech when it comes to, as we talked about yesterday, the right being angry that stories they want to see in the mainstream don't get enough attention because they're dumb stories. They say that it's suppression of speech. Now, of course, media outlets and people can choose. I want to talk about this or I don't want to talk about that. It's not necessarily an indication of suppression of speech or censorship or self-censorship. Some stories are just kind of dumb. Then when there are consequences to their speech, they say, well, that's a restriction of my freedom of speech. No, you were allowed to speak and say what you wanted about the election results or about lab leak or Hunter Biden or whatever. But also there are reactions to your speech by people who themselves have the right to speak as well. But they don't like that. That's not good. But then here, instead of this just being a reaction, a consequence to the speech of Mr. Wilburn, they actually go over the line because threatening people with a lynching or with a personal injury or calling them and leaving repeated racial slurs, those may be the consequences to Wilburn's speech. But that goes beyond into criminality, because those are now threats and it's harassment. So, like, on every level on this speech thing, enforcing terms of service is not a First Amendment violation. It's not even the government. It's a private company enforcing their terms of service. Reaction to the thing I said, well, now my speech is being suppressed by that speech. No, it's just the consequence of your speech. And as long as it's not illegal, threatening, or otherwise against the law, it's just something you have to deal with. When you speak, people might react to that. Okay, well, then I'm going to react to what Wilburn said by threatening with a lynching. No, that actually is a crime at this point in time. It's a continued and persistent misunderstanding of every aspect of what free speech, censorship, and the ability to say what you want to say, and media outlets to cover what they want to cover. They misunderstand all of it at every single level. Obviously, in the case of Mr. Wilburn, let's hope they actually find the people who made those horrible racist threats. Speaking of threats, Congressman Matt Gaetz, who continues to be at risk of being charged for a number of different things, including possibly trafficking a minor, a sex trafficking a minor. He gave a very strange speech on the floor of the House on Wednesday where he said he thinks someone may be trying to kill him. And let's take a listen to what he had to say.
I'd like to yield the first 2 minutes to my colleague from Florida, Representative Gaetz.
Without objection.
I thank the gentleman for yielding, because I think someone may be trying to kill me. And if they are successful, I would like my constituents and my family to know who stopped their arrest.
Wow.
Madam Speaker, on October 8th, 2021, a Twitter handle styled CIA Bob is at your door tweeted to at Rep. Matt Gaetz, "Looky here, pal. I lived in Portland. Portland has ordered a hit on you. I accepted the contract. Have a good day." Following this tweet, this individual traveled to Washington, D.C., and the Capitol Police recommended his arrest. That's information that was just shared with me by the Investigations and Threat Assessment section of the Protective Services Bureau, and specifically George DeCesso. And George shared with me that the Capitol Police recommended the arrest of this individual, and that the Department of Justice refused to do so, declined to do so. And on the eve of the Attorney General testifying before the Judiciary Committee tomorrow, it is just yet another example of the Department of Justice having a double standard.
So we don't know how much of this is true. If someone threatened him on Twitter and then flew to, across, presuming it's Portland, Oregon, flew across the country to Washington, D.C., that individual should be arrested. If the individual wasn't arrested and everything else is true, we should know why. If the Department of Justice said don't arrest, we should know why. But imagine if the floor of the House was taken over by members announcing every threat that they get on Twitter. There's so many questions here, including whether Gaetz is even telling the truth about this. But in all seriousness, often death threats are not something you want to announce publicly because it encourages way more of them. I told this story once, long after it took place, of someone who had been sending me threats, and I didn't mention anything about it at the time for years. I ultimately learned that the FBI went to the house of this individual, and it was someone living very rurally. The way it was described by the FBI, it was an extremely I don't want to be insulting, but the FBI said, "This is someone without the resources or volition to carry out the threats." And imagine if all along I had been announcing the fact that this threat was going on, and it ended up being a particular threat of no consequence or significance at all. But all the time people are hearing about it, and it's encouraging copycats, and it's encouraging more threats and that type of thing. I just don't know, other than grandstanding and other than trying to make some statement of political bias, that the Department of Justice only wants to protect Democrats from death threats and not Republicans or something like that. I don't even know why this is being discussed on the floor of the House. And of course, in the meantime, understand that Matt Gaetz is under investigation by federal authorities for sex crimes. That's really what the focus should be. And I read one comment that said he's just already trying to argue that federal authorities have a bias against him to if he is indeed charged by those same departments, if the DOJ ultimately charges him, he can come in and maybe try to use this as a defense. Listen, these people have it out for me. When we reported a death threat and that, you know, Capitol Police said the person should be arrested, they didn't even do it. I don't know if Matt Gaetz has that amount of foresight. Maybe it's his lawyers. I don't know. It's certainly plausible, but not something we actually have evidence as the motivation for him doing this. But a very strange declaration to be making on the floor of the House, both for security reasons about not publicizing threats and because of the fact that he's currently being investigated by federal authorities for a bunch of different pretty serious crimes. Let me know your thoughts. You can find me on Twitter at @DPacman. We'll take a break. And we have a lot coming up for you today. Remember that the David Pakman Show is made possible primarily by viewers and listeners who sign up on our website and get themselves a membership. Memberships are cheap. They're easy to sign up for. It takes about a minute with average computer skills. And you get access to great stuff like the bonus show, commercial-free streams of the show, on and on. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. And if you want a discount, you can use the coupon code BETTER21. Let's take some calls from people. We do calls now via Discord. You can join the Discord at davidpacman.com/Discord. Let's speak first today to Ryan from Maryland. Ryan from Maryland, you are on the air.
Hey, David. How's my audio? Is it okay?
It's beautiful.
All right. Fantastic. My second time talking to you, so appreciate you taking the call.
Pleasure.
So I work, I'm a cybersecurity professional, kind of the DC, Maryland area, and I've always been really interested in getting your take on kind of the political ramifications of cyber attacks. So, you know, there's a lot. We look at things like the Colonial Pipeline attack, traced to DarkSide, which is an Eastern European group.
Yep.
We look at the SolarWinds attack, APT-29, Eastern European group. You know, there's a clear asymmetry in our response, naturally so, right? Is like, how do we respond at a political level to these kind of ambiguous, or at least attacks where the damage is kind of ambiguous, right? And
yeah.
You know, I think it's clear if we're, you know, attacked in a major city, you know, the carriers go out to the ocean and we have a clear military response. But for these, it's kind of a more subtle political engagement between, you know, and it may not be government to government, but I've always been curious, like, how do we measure what is an appropriate response from a kind of a political perspective when we can clearly trace through cyber forensics that there's likely a government involvement in some of these kind of infrastructure attacks?
This is a really tough question. One approach to saying, okay, if you believe that there should be an equivalent response when something like this is done, your first step would be, how do we quantify the damages? This would be one way to approach it. So you would have to do an analysis and say, what dollar value can we put on the damages? What human value can we put? If nobody died, but there were $2 billion essentially in damages, do you just turn around and say, how do we do $2 billion in damage to the country that did this without killing anybody? Like, is it that utilitarian?
Right.
This is sort of a new front in a sense. So I don't know. You know, I recently read a book it's a real page turner. I read it on vacation by Robert Ludlum, who wrote the Born Supremacy, Born, all those books. A different one where there's a group that wants to poison the American water supply. They identify, I think it's like 5 or 7 aquifers or whatever the case may be. And, you know, they have this plan. And it's like that could kill an untold number of people. And it seems much more clear cut, for better or worse, what kind of a reaction you would see the government take in such a situation against the offending country. With some of the things you're thinking about, it's much more complex. And I don't immediately know how we quantify what our response should be.
Yeah, that's really it. Is sometimes it's unquantifiable, right? It's like there's a lot of qualitative damage that we can assess, but it's hard to kind of put numbers around it.
Absolutely.
And I think one of my other concerns is, you know, I'm seeing some of the work I do is on ICS, which is like industrial control systems. And so a lot of our infrastructure, water supply, power grid, that has been intentionally not connected to the internet for a very long time.
Yes.
And they're starting to bring this infrastructure online, which is obviously opening it up, you know, from an attack vector perspective. And so I think, you know, some of the dialogue around what a political response would be in the event of these infrastructure attacks is definitely going to have to ramp up as we start to see more and more attempts at kind of disrupting this infrastructure. So I think it's kind of an interesting front, and you're right. I mean, I think there's no clear answer, at least not yet, especially in situations where the damage is a little bit more subtle and unquantifiable. But
yes,
yeah.
And you've got to make sure as you bring these systems on the internet that they are adequately robust in terms of being protected. And I think that's one of the concerns as that starts to happen, as you're pointing out.
Yeah, I mean, and these systems are super antiquated, right?
Yep.
So bringing these online is such a challenge, and just seeing how vulnerable even really complex systems are, it does give me I wouldn't say it keeps me up at night, but it does give me some concern from what I see at kind of the professional level. But yeah, interesting to see kind of how this plays out from a political perspective in the future. But
yeah,
I wanted to get your take on that, so I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. Important topic. Great to hear from you. Something I'm sure we will be addressing again. Let's go next to Audrey from Georgia. Audrey, you are on the air.
Hi, David. I believe we've talked before.
Excellent.
But I had an interesting question for you. I was on yesterday, wanted to ask. So I studied Chinese in college, and I was talking with my Chinese professor yesterday.
Now, sorry, sorry to interrupt. Did you study Mandarin or Cantonese?
Mandarin.
Ah, okay, good.
And I came to the conclusion that I think China is a little bit like kind of – I think we treat them very biased in our media and especially in our education. And I wanted to get your take on that. Do you think that China in many ways is – sort of like demonized in our media? Like if you look in the news, it's always something bad about them. There's never any reports on like the good things going on in there, like scientific research and everything.
Yeah, I would generally speaking agree that there is China is an economic adversary. There is no question about that. But they're also an economic partner, and that's what makes this so complex. On the one hand, we have an economy that for decades has been based on being able to get cheap stuff from China. That's what it is. If we didn't get cheap stuff from China and we couldn't quickly get it elsewhere and had to bring all production domestically, we'd be buying American, as some people say, but things would cost dramatically more. And what I see is an asymmetry in if we want to recognize China as an economic adversary and along with Russia up there with the U.S. as being in a battle to be the major of the three major superpowers, that's fine. That's accurate. I have no problem identifying China in that way. But so many of the people who wildly talk about China virus and intellectual property theft and this stuff seem to not know or recognize that our entire way of life, including the purchasing power that we have, is based on the fact that we get so much of our products from China. And I think it would be great to have a more balanced perspective on that.
All right. And I was more talking about also like in education, very few people in the United States seem to know anything about like the politics or the general like daily life of what it's like for people in China. They just see it.
That's
sort
not
of
super
like,
surprising, though, that it's very common that people in the United States also know very little about the lives of people in Russia or in Japan or in Denmark. Now, you could say, well, China's more important to know about for the reasons you're laying out. But it's not surprising that U.S. education, at least at the K-12 level, is very U.S. centric.
I mean, like in U.S. education, we learn all about how the Japanese and British parliament and everything works. But there's absolutely no involvement in how other countries such as like how Russia's or how China's politics work. And I think it's something important that we need to recognize if we're going to have those important political discussions all over the news about, you know, like China getting rid of term limits or anything. If you're going to understand that, you have to have at least a basic knowledge of how it works.
I agree with you. I agree with you completely. Audrey, thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
All right. There is Audrey. Let's go next to, oh, we don't often get calls from Idaho. Let's go to Barbara from Idaho.
Hi, David. Can you hear me?
Barbara, I can hear you fine. Or at least I could. Are you still there? Barbara's gone. That's too bad. Barbara left. Was really looking forward to that. I would love to know what's happening in Idaho. It's a closed book for me. Let me put it that way. Let's go to Tyler from St. Louis. Tyler, you're on the air.
Hey, David. I'm not eating a sandwich this time.
Okay, good.
I guess I didn't really have a question. I just wanted to apologize to the Pac-Man community for subjecting their ears to that.
You listened back and the sandwich eating was a distraction during your last call, in other words.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think apology accepted. Now we've sorted it out.
All right. That's all I had to say.
Okay, good. But next time, definitely mute the Discord blings. That would be the thing to work on for the next call.
Yeah,
there's another one. Yep.
Yeah, that's something to do to push the talk. I don't know how to turn that off. I have no idea why my microphone picks that up.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Thank you for the call. We've gotten everything up to date as far as that's concerned. Let's go next to Nate from Rhode Island. Nate, you are on the air. Nate from Rhode Island, you're on the air. And Nate from Rhode Island gone. Wow. Things taking a turn. Let's see if Chris from Baltimore can save us. Chris, you are now on the air.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Wow. That's crazy. Well, I just wanted to ask a random question. Basically, like, if you were the president and you had executive order, you know, privileges.
Sure.
What would be the first executive order you passed? Assuming you could only do one, what would you do?
I have no idea. It's such a weird, I mean, the thing about these questions, they're almost sort of like, would you rather only eat avocados for the next 5 years or have to do 1,000 sit-ups before you could drink water each day? It's like, I don't know. It's unlikely to ever be a scenario. If I could, I don't know what it would be. I mean, here's the thing. If I was really going to be in the position of getting to sign one executive order, first, I would want to be fully briefed as to all of the things that can even be done via executive order so that I could be informed and really evaluate. Like, I could just say to you, the first thing I would do is I would forgive some student debt or something like that. If I knew the full scope of what a president could do via EO, I might say something completely different. So I don't know. I'm not good at these kind of forced questions. Let me ask you a question. If the only breakfast you could eat for a year was oatmeal with hot dogs in it or apples, which one would you go with?
I see what you're trying to say. I mean, probably the hot dog option. But
wow. That's crazy. For me, that's an easy question. I would go with the apples, but okay, that's fair. All right.
David, thank you so much, man. I'm a huge fan.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling in. There's Chris from Baltimore. Let's take a very quick break. If you're holding, hang on for me. We're going to go right back to the phones in a moment. All right, let's get back to your calls via Discord. Find the David Pacman Show Discord at davidpacman.com/Discord. Very, very easy. It works beautifully. I mean, really, really beautifully. Let's go. I'm told Nate from Rhode Island now knows what to do to talk to me. Nate from Rhode Island, you are on the air.
Hi, David. My mic was muted last time. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
So I had a question. What is the best way to oust Manchin and Sinema apart from voting them out at the next opportunity?
Well, that's the only way as far as I know. You've got to vote. What other ways do you have in mind? I hope you're not talking about like an assassination.
No.
How else do you get them out other than them losing an election or retiring?
I was curious, is there a way to, like, with the whole, like, I don't know if the whole vote of no confidence thing is actually a way to oust them out, if that's just like a formal thing? Or
No, I think it's just a formality. I mean, listen, here's the thing. I think Bill Scheer actually said it really, really well This applies more to Manchin than to Sinema.
Yeah.
It would be very hard to replace Manchin with a more liberal Democrat in the Senate.
Because it's such a deep red state, yeah.
In the Senate, right. So without Manchin right now, Democrats don't even have a majority, and Mitch McConnell prevents all of the things we're talking about from even being on the floor of the Senate. So really, you've got to replace some Republicans with Democrats. That actually is what needs to be done. Manchin in West Virginia, I don't know, like, if you manage to defeat him in a primary, that person almost certainly loses the general election.
Yeah.
So I just don't know. I mean, I didn't overstate. Right after the November 2020 election, I said, Joe Manchin's going to be a problem. And a lot of people wrote to me and they said, sir, you're overstating that. And I said, yeah. No. And it turned out that I and others were right. But the solution isn't get Manchin out and have a Republican be in a seat. It's we got to flip some Republican seats.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get more progressives in the 2022 midterms. Fingers crossed with that.
Yeah, I haven't done a full breakdown of what's possible in the Senate in 22. It's not impossible, but it's going to be an uphill battle.
Yeah, it makes sense. All right. Yeah. Thanks for the call, David.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for calling me. I should start calling people. That's actually not a bad idea. I like that idea. Let's go to Ricardo from Oklahoma.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Excellent. Excellent. What a pleasure. What an honor, actually.
Pleasure.
My question to you is, we talk a lot about fake news.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about social engineering. Do you think fake news is social engineering?
In what way would it be social engineering?
So fake news sounds very easy, very simple. You know, somebody just posts something fake online and it's fake news. So social engineering has a more, a deeper purpose, you know, it has a strategy behind it. Like right now on YouTube, you can see commercials of Donald Trump saying that he's asking a lot of people to vaccinate and all that, but he's also asking for money somewhere else. So to me, that's kind of like social engineering, trying to have people believe he's a good person asking for people to vaccinate. Yet to me, that's a way to ask for money and convince people to get money. You see what I'm saying?
So the definition of social engineering is some kind of central plan to manage social change and regulate the behavior of a society. So the way that fake news could be social engineering would be, if one view of fake news would be fake news spreads really easily, and so it's profitable. And so individually, all of these purveyors of fake news put out fake news, not to influence society, but just to make money. Like, that would be fake news not being social engineering. You could say fake news was social engineering if there was a concerted effort in order to influence people to behave a certain way on the basis of fake news that is being spread. So like, you could say maybe there's a social engineering motivation for fake news spread about the vaccine. And that would be to further some political goal or to cause chaos at school board meetings or whatever the case may be. So sure. I mean, in that sense, the coordinated spread of fake news could be a form of social engineering. I don't know that we know that to be the case necessarily.
Okay. I appreciate your time and your show. It's a great show, great source of information and knowledge. And I appreciate you taking my call.
Thanks, Ricardo. I appreciate you calling in. Interesting. Interesting for sure. Let's go next as we take phone calls. Let's go back to Rhode Island. Let's go to Jen from Providence, Rhode Island.
Hi, David. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Jen.
All right. Is this on speaker? Weird. All right. So I have a question. I know that you're interested in social and history and everything.
Sure.
Have you looked into what happened after the 1918 pandemic, how there was a similar kind of labor shortage and how workers used it to demand higher wages? And there was kind of a social movement going on, and then the Teamsters rose up.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, do you think we're kind of repeating history with that, and we might be able to use this to our advantage to get better wages?
Yes. In fact, I did a story on the Wednesday show about the spread of strikes and worker protests across the country. and made the point that the pandemic may have generated the, you know, ideal maybe is a little too much, but favorable conditions for workers to use newfound leverage to demand better working conditions and better wages. Now, as far as 1918 and the flu, I did not know. I've studied the 1918 pandemic a bit, and we've done one or two interviews about it. I didn't know about the impact there on strikes and worker rights beyond just it was the tail end of the progressive era during which we saw activism for wages and better working conditions. But as ushered in by the pandemic, I wasn't familiar with that, and I will look into it. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, and it was kind of the same thing that what's going on now. There was a huge wage gap, and those workers that for the first time were able to afford things like automobiles and appliances that were just coming into existence, the middle class rose to be until the, you know, 1929 when the stock market crashed. So I kind of wonder, you know, we're at the same wage gap that maybe we could kind of make up some of the space, like what they did 100 years ago.
That, I mean, it's possible. And we're going to keep following these strike movements and see what they develop. And, you know, I would, from a self-centered standpoint, I would love that. And a lot of times people say, David, I don't understand. Like, why are you saying it would be good for you for workers to earn higher wages? Like, what, how does that affect you? And as I've explained so many times before, the way I earn money is by people getting memberships on my website and buying the products and services sold by my advertisers. That's how I make money. If an advertiser does well, they buy more ads. And so if more people have disposable income, they're not living paycheck to paycheck, that's dramatically growing the pool of people that can afford to get a membership or buy something from an advertiser. So I am thrilled about these protests, because I think that they're the right thing and that workers deserve rights. And also from a selfish standpoint, as an entrepreneur, it's great for me as well. And so I don't get the wholehearted opposition that we see from so many places.
Yeah, I'm in the similar boat as that. I'm a waitress, and people are going to tip more if they have a little bit of extra money in their pocket.
Absolutely. It's demand side stimulus. And whether you know that that's what it is or you don't, working people understand that when people have more money, it's also better for me.
Yeah, and just better for the economy overall, sure. And better for, you know, depression, things like that. People
Absolutely.
Are just happier.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, I thank you. You are my favorite YouTuber. And hey, it's my birthday tomorrow, so this is a good early birthday present.
All right. Happy early birthday, Jen from Providence. Great to hear from you. Really, really strong phone calls today. It's actually shocking me. Let's see. Where do we want to go next? Let's go north of the border. Let's go to Alex from Quebec.
Hi, David. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Bienvenue.
Merci beaucoup. I'm actually a first-time caller. And before the pandemic in Quebec, the government had promised electoral reform away from first-past-the-post and into a mixed member proportional representation system.
Sure.
But among the advocates of electoral reform, there was a big debate between those who wanted proportional representation and those who preferred, a preferential voting system. Justin Trudeau actually was more of an advocate of the second option, while the provincial government preferred the first option. And I was just wondering, what was your preference between the two?
Well, I always hesitate to weigh in specifically about questions in front of other countries, because I just don't feel as if I'm as well informed as I could be or should be really to be commenting. But I've talked over the years about a number of different reforms to how we do our elections that I would welcome. I would love a proportional representation system, big picture, because it could be a way for third parties to make inroads in the United States. The risk, of course, is you get 5% white supremacists or something crazy, and that's something that would have to be dealt with, and we would have to think about that. But I think proportional representation, especially in the U.S., where this two-party duopoly is a complete and total mess, would be an interesting thing. switching away from first past the post to something like single transferable vote or one of the many different ranked choice voting systems that don't have some of the problems that we've identified in a few of the systems would also be very much welcome. A combination of the two is something that I would be open to. I welcome that. And in the U.S., I've talked about it a lot. You know, in the context of Canada, it seems more appropriate to ask someone who's been following the Canadian discussion.
Well, in my honest opinion,
yes,
everyone just advocates for the reform that advantages them.
Generally.
So, for example, yeah, Justin Trudeau leads a centrist party, so of course he will prefer a preferential voting system.
Yes.
Because if he ends up against a right-wing candidate, he'll get the left-wing vote, and mm-hmm. if he ends up against a left-wing candidate, he'll get the right-wing vote. Whereas in Quebec, where the main issue has been nationalist, not in the sense of like white nationalist as in America, but nationalist as in wanting more autonomy for the province, wanting to protect the French language and so on.
Of course.
Yeah, usually these parties have split the vote between left and right-wing nationalists, allowing for, well, parties who aren't that to win more seats than they should have. And so Quebec nationalists, of course, prefer a proportional voting system to increase their representation.
Yeah. On that front, what are the rules right now in terms of the signage in Quebec? Is it that the signs have to be only in French, or it has to be French first and larger?
Well, in the 70s, they tried to make it only in French.
Uh-huh.
And the Supreme Court of Canada said, you're not allowed to do that. That's infringing on freedom of speech.
Okay.
And so today it's predominantly French. That means you can put it in English, but the font has to be smaller than in French.
Understood.
I think there's an exception in native communities where you are allowed to have signages only in like Inuit or Huron or
right.
stuff like that, because we want to protect French, but we don't want to like and native languages.
Are like you day to day? What's the how much French versus English are you speaking? Is it 90-10? Is it?
I almost don't. Well, I live in a rural region, so far away from Montreal. Where in Montreal you need English.
Yes,
but outside of that, you don't really need to. I only learned to speak English at 14.
Okay,
so. It really wasn't a necessity in my day-to-day life.
Yeah, understood. All right, very good. Fascinating to hear about what's going on in Quebec. I appreciate the call.
All right, thank you, David.
All right, thank you. Really great topics today. Really, really great topics. Let's speak to, how about, Is this Jake from Massachusetts? Hold on. Is it? Oh, no, it's do not call on. Did not want me to call on. Sorry. But wow. I apologize. Somebody was just they left a note saying don't call on me. And it just looked so interesting that I had to go with it. Let's go to Michael from Berlin. Michael, you're on the air.
Hey, David.
Yes.
Great to hear from you.
Pleasure.
I'm actually Berlin, New Jersey.
So oh,
that's
okay.
Why I don't have an accent. But
all right. Well, actually, you do have an accent, but it's a Jersey accent.
Yes.
Thank you.
I visited Germany 13 times, though, because my parents are from Austria. So I'm a first generation Austrian American.
Now, let me inquire about that. You went to Germany 13 times because your parents are from Austria. Why not go to Austria?
Well, I've been to, I'm sorry, to clarify, Frankfurt Airport.
Oh.
And then went from Frankfurt to Vienna, Austria.
Got it.
And so that was about 13 times through Frankfurt.
Got it.
So I'm a little nervous. This is the first time I've ever called any show.
You're doing great so far.
This is actually on my bucket list. And that's one of the things I was going to ask you. What was on your bucket list?
Oh, I don't have anything. I don't ever think about in those terms, unfortunately. I couldn't.
Okay.
I don't have a bucket list.
Okay. Well, my bucket list, I just wanted to give an example. My bucket list would be to travel the United States. I'm into endurance events, and I would love to go for a long distance bike tour of the U.S. and just meeting people and discussing, meeting with different people and talking about, you know, other things, local things, you know, just learning from different cultures in the U.S. And maybe talk about democracy, how we can help our democracy get along. Because
excellent.
A lot of people don't understand the process of just getting involved in local politics.
Absolutely. That seems like a worthy thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I need a leave of absence, though. That will take me like a month or a couple months to do. But
oh, yeah. I would set aside some time for that.
Yeah. I'd like to shout out to Egbert as well, who was from Vienna. He was a caller, and he hasn't called in for a while. And I really enjoyed his you know, when he called in.
All right. Very good. Shout out to Egbert from Austria. I so appreciate the call. We are going to speak to a couple of other people here. Let's go to Tony from Philly. Tony from Philly, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Hey, do I sound fine? Do I sound okay?
You sound like you're completely underwater. What are you saying?
How about that? Do I sound better now?
You know, now it's perfectly clear, yeah.
Okay. Well, first off, hey, David, how you doing? It's been
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you.
Last time I called in, we actually spoke about reparations, and I was a little upset because you titled the video "Caller Argues About Reparations," and it was more of a discussion and not an argument. But
okay, all right, we'll investigate.
Small potatoes, you know, sometimes those, you know, I enjoyed my discussion with you about it.
Good.
It wasn't, there wasn't any real issue that I had with you labeling it that way. Just a little joke.
All right. What's on your mind today?
I wanted to say how I think what we need to do is really amend the Constitution to get 50% control of the corporate boards of directors. In order to really get control over this political environment. I think people need to be in direct control of the workplace, and that's the natural next step
Let's explore what you mean. Okay. Get control of 50%. Who to control 50% of boards of directors?
An employee board of directors, pretty much almost like a union,
uh-huh.
Except they would have direct control, 50% direct control.
So, half the seats, let's talk through it calmly so we can understand it. Half the seats of the corporation's board of directors would be held by employees that presumably are not executives, right? It's that they're workers.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And once a company reaches what size would this start? Like, I'm guessing this wouldn't apply to like tiny little businesses.
Only publicly traded companies.
Oh, or only publicly traded.
Or a company that controls way too much of the market share for a given industry.
What about like a huge nonprofit with 1,000 employees that's not publicly traded? Would it apply to them as well?
You know, honestly, I haven't thought it out that far.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I like this idea. This is when we talk about democratization of the workplace outside of the context of I'm not a socialist. So just saying the workers just automatically own the company and that's it. There's no more private ownership. Like, I'm not a socialist, so I don't support that. But when we talk about democratization of the workplace, saying that after a certain level, it is required to have employee representation on a board, that's a great idea. That's exactly the type of thing that I find interesting. So I, you know, when you say we need a constitutional amendment, I don't know if it's done constitutionally. Corporations are typically registered at individual states. Maybe it's a state by state thing. I don't know the legality of it, but I'm fascinated by the idea. I think we're thinking big ideas here.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. I just wanted to bring it up to you and see if I could get a yay or nay out of you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for the call. Very much appreciate it. That's going to do it for today. We took some great calls. We will take calls again, and we will now go to a very short break and then be back with more of today's show. All right, everybody, let's get to this week's mailbag, an increasingly popular segment. People seem to be loving this segment other than the people who hate it. And that's about, I don't know, judging from my email, it's not a zero. It's a non-zero number of people. No, but we keep getting more and more emails and interesting things. So let's just get right into it. First, message from Moose. Moose says, Mr. Pacman, sir, While eating lunch in the teacher's lounge today, I overheard some coaches discussing the new vaccine in China with a 58% fatality rate. The conversation quickly went into one of the coaches telling everyone, China's working on a vaccine to get rid of our sight and hearing because they already created COVID, which damaged our taste and smell. I long blinked and facepalmed. What are your thoughts? Obviously, it's all bonkers. But what's interesting about that is they seem to concede COVID was created to damage our taste and smell. So now they're going to make a vaccine to get rid of our sight and hearing. But I thought the problem with COVID was the vaccine, not the virus. I thought the point was the vaccine kills you. As you can see, there are various conspiracy theories that COVID was created to take away to damage our taste and smell, but that the vaccine, which prevents that for many people, actually is what kills you. But then now they're going to do a new, quote, vaccine in order to take people's sight and hearing. It's all completely incoherent. It's all absolute and complete nonsense. It doesn't make any sense. And yet this type of stuff keeps spreading. I wonder where maybe moose is a sign that moose is in, you know, some part of the country with moose. And that's where you got a lot of teachers who believe this stuff. I don't know. It would be interesting to know what school district that is. But those people are teaching some of your kids. Some of your kids are being taught by those folks. That is horrifying. That is absolutely and completely horrifying. Next email is from Bill. Bill says, ask this question. Does Steve Scalise believe that his own election was legitimate? Same ballots, same election. Yeah, this is something I pointed out. I think it was in December, which is you've got all these people saying the results of the presidential election were bogus, bogus, can't be trusted. They're fake, fraud, whatever. But all of the other races on the same ballots, like the senators and the members of Congress and all that stuff, those are fine. How exactly did they pull that off? And that would have been, this is a reference to the interview that Chris Wallace did with Steve Scalise that we looked at last week, where Chris Wallace was saying, did Trump win or was it stolen from him? Did Trump win? Was it stolen from him? You know, all this type of stuff. Did Biden win or was it stolen from him? And Steve Scalise basically answered the question three or four different ways, none of which were actually direct answers. A great question would be, were there also the same degree of irregularities and possible fraud in your election, Steve Scalise? Because you were on those same ballots, and I don't know what he would say. He'd probably have some kind of workaround, would be my prediction. Next email is from Chase. Chase says, David, audits are okay. Why not allow all those demanding audits to have their way? But first, they have to agree to some requirements. Number one, they must cover all audit expenses, including for experienced objective observers. Two, counting must be done in publicly viewed areas. Another number two, must agree to no access to personal voter information nor voter machine tampering. And number three, which is really number four, if they find verifiable significant fraud, then the taxpayers will reimburse all reasonable expenses. This would force them to put up or shut up. It sort of would, Chase, but the problem is that they would still fundraise for it. So as they've been doing, and Trump was able to raise tens of millions saying we're going to use this money to fight voter fraud and the like. So I don't really know that would be the solution to bogus audits. The bigger issue is, what does it even really mean to do an audit? And that's a word that's often used, which has different meanings or no meaning at all, depending on where it's taking place. And so I think it's a bigger systemic problem, but I don't disagree that saying you've got to pay is a good idea. In some cases, they have paid, or at least they funded the process themselves. It hasn't really deterred too much, but certainly there should be a financial disincentive from doing this unless they, you know, really, really believe it, which many of them I know don't. It could serve to dissuade some of this nonsense behavior. Next email today is from Adrian. Adrian writes in about autocracy, fascism, and Republicans and says, I watch your channel. I watch TYT and others. I also occasionally look at the opposite views to give myself perspective. Smart thing to do. I'm becoming more and more worried about 2022 and 2024. We've become rather comfortable in our world post-World War II, but should we? Can we say for sure that a new Nazi party will never happen again. Look at the grand old party, meaning the Republican Party, and those within it who have always been there, but due to Trump and his rhetoric now feel they have the license to spout their true nature as if it was commonplace, should make those of us with any semblance of decency shudder with fear. Yeah, this is a good point. And I've said many times before, anybody who has the idea X can never happen or X can never happen again needs to rethink that and be more cautious. Hopefully certain things won't happen or won't happen again. But listen, you know, when Trump said at the State of the Union a couple of times, we will never be a socialist country. Maybe we will. Unpredictable things happen. And how Trump can say the U.S. will never be socialist, what about in 100 years? What about 500 years? We don't know that. And much the same way for people who say Nazism, Hitler stuff could never happen again. Assuming it couldn't is part of what could allow it to. And that's why all of this drama and delusion related to the January 6th riots and the slow motion coup that now is being discussed more and more cannot be ignored, should not be ignored. And that's part of why we continue to talk about it. Andrew wrote in about the microchip shortage and says, sirs, so much has been made of the current microchip shortage, and I can't believe the nonsense that is being spread. Misinformation about shipping issues, and this is satire, by the way, and manufacturing backlogs is reaching ridiculous proportions. It's very simple. Every vaccine has a microchip, and now every booster will have one as well. This is why there is a microchip shortage. Wake up, sheeple. It's sad, but even though I'm telling you this is satire, I will get comments. Just if you're watching this on YouTube right now, look down below. You'll see comments that don't realize that that's satire. It's satire. It's a joke. It's poking fun at the disinformation anti-vaxxers. All right, everybody relax. It's just satire. Trust me, it's satire. Lukian wrote in. Lukian says, David, you've been repeatedly accused of being, quote, bought by Big Pharma. This is, of course, unsubstantiated nonsense. An interesting response, I believe, could be for you to share the following stories of how YouTubers around the world are being paid to promote anti-vax conspiracies, which is literally the opposite of what you are accused of. Yeah, without evidence and without even plausibility, people accuse me of being in the pocket of Big Pharma. I'm getting money from Big Pharma to promote the vaccine. Now, all I've ever done is report the data and the statistics on vaccine studies. But there actually are anti-vaccine influencers and money floating around to them to question the efficacy of the vaccines, to promote alternative treatments as if they are ironclad treatments for COVID, on and on and on. That's actually where the money is. Why would anyone pay me to, quote, promote a vaccine? The data says it really protects you from serious illness and death. We see the overwhelming number of deaths among the unvaccinated. I really went and got the vaccine. Nobody paid me to go and get it. Why would anyone pay me to promote the vaccine? It doesn't make any sense, nor is there evidence that people are being paid to promote it. There is evidence people are being paid to promote anti-vax ideas. Sometimes it's soft anti-vaxxerism, which is talking about disproportionately focusing on side effects or talking about there's plenty of alternative treatments, et cetera. Sometimes it's straight up anti-vax, like conspiracy theory, microchip, 5G, your arm gets magnetized sort of stuff. There's a combination of both. They're the ones that we know, some of whom have gotten paid. Next email. I love these. Oh, David, you lie so much. It's scary. No wonder your channel is dying. I really love these because it's so not true and it angers them that the channels aren't dying. We actually had last week. I don't even know why this is happening. We had the best week last week for the audio podcast since the week of the insurrection. You've got to go back 10 and a half months for a week where we had the same number of audio podcast downloads as last week. The audio podcast has been exploding. We have more subscribers than ever on YouTube. We reached 1.4 million. I'm really excited about getting to 1.5 million. We had something like 30 million YouTube views last month, extremely healthy number. And these folks have been around for a long time. Oh, you're circling the drain. Any day now, you're going to be down to zero viewers. The show has never been bigger, and it's a really exciting thing to see. All right, one last bonus message. This one's from Facebook's. This one is from an individual whom I shall not name, who says, you need to stop pushing lies. You're accusing this woman of lying. You are the liar. The vaccine has not been approved. You might as well move to Venezuela or Nazi Germany. If that's what you think, I think it would be best for you to shut up. Not a single punctuation mark, not a single, well, I guess the apostrophe in your and that's count. Not a single comma, not a single period, just a run on. This is the run on from hell, I guess is what I would say. And it's kind of funny also, Venezuela or Nazi Germany, both regimes which I oppose for different reasons and which have very little in common with each other. Sad stuff. Sad stuff, my friends. Get your emails in for the mailbag, info@davidpakman.com, info@davidpakman.com. But, and this is a really serious thing, please don't email us every day. Please don't email us multiple times a day. There are now probably about 50 people in the audience who relentlessly email us every single day about things related to politics and things not related to politics. If you're doing that, we almost certainly are not seeing your emails. When we see someone does this stuff, emailing in a dozen times a day, sometimes more, and they clog our inbox, it really restricts our ability to go through and find substantive material. So those are getting filtered directly into the trash. And just think, am I emailing David every day? Am I emailing David multiple times a day? If you are, we're almost certainly not seeing the messages because they're just being auto-filtered. We just can't keep up with that. It's not what the mailbag and what the email address is set up for. You know, let's be sensible, my friends. Let's be sensible. Email is info@davidpakman.com. We have a phenomenal bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpakman.com to get instant access. And we've got a whole new week of shows.
I'm Andrew Saul, Commissioner of Social Security. Beware of telephone scammers pretending to be government employees. Real Social Security employees will never threaten you. Callers threatening you with arrest or other legal action and demanding money are not from us. If you receive a call like this, hang up. Do not provide them with any form of payment or information. Report the call at oig.ssa.gov.
Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.
Running from the cops all night. Hide and ride,
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. My name is Steve, your host for the next 60 minutes of classic and traditional blues here on the Deep Blues Hour. In this hour, we're going to hear from Catfish Keith, a nice contemporary acoustic steel guitar player, Reverend Gary Davis and Pink Anderson together, a nice blues gospel tune, Robert Pete Williams singing about cows, plus Lightning Hopkins. All coming up here on this next hour of the Deep Blues Hour. Stick around, lots of good music coming your way. And we're going to start off with Zora Young. Here she is, or here he is, I should say. The Stumbling Blocks and Stepping Stones. Zora Young on the Deep Blues Hour.